From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. We have a special night ahead of us. I haven't done this in a long time where I have six guests on at the same time. Actually, five out of six are here. We're just waiting for the sixth to log in. Have you been to the Women in Crime, Inc. blog? Well, if you haven't been, go do it now. www.womenincrimeinc.com. Inc is I-N-K dot blogspot.com. And I'm very pleased tonight to have from there Pat Brown, who is a criminal profiler. Stacey Dietrich is a policewoman slash novelist. Diane Fanning is a crime author that has the new book, The Trophy Exchange, out. Vanessa Leggett will join us in a little bit. She's a crime writer. Donna Pendergrast is a prosecutor who specializes in murder cases. And Robin Sachs is a L.A. County sex crimes prosecutor. Good evening, ladies.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
This is a special show for us this evening because we have talked before, some of us, of course, Robin and Pat have been guests on my program, but it's so neat to see a blog like what you guys are doing now on the internet, because the internet has exploded. We're more information on there than you can shake a stick at as far as information. And comparing it to the mainstream media, there is no comparison. We get it right. They get it wrong half the time. And I think Vanessa Leggett has just joined us. Hi, Vanessa.
Hello.
How are you?
Great. How are you doing, Dana?
I'm great. I'm great. Everyone is here now. And again, if you're just joining us, the gals, or at least six of them, from womenincrimeinc.blogspot.com, or the Women in Crime blog, is here, or are here tonight with us. And I want to start with Vanessa. For those that are just tuning in for the first time and haven't heard of you guys, tell us a little bit about the blog.
Well, it is a collaborative effort of women who are writers and also have some foot in the criminal justice system in some regard. There are 17 of us, and we've got everything from a defense attorney to two prosecutors who I believe are both with us now. We also have a forensics specialist, and true crime authors, mystery writers, just about everything that you could, you know, imagine.
Yeah, for you know, people from 48 Hours, Stacey, police women, woman slash novelist. You know, that's something different. How does a cop become a writer?
It was kind of a relief, put it bluntly. I started my writing about 2 years ago. My first fiction novel comes out this October. I'm trying to lean towards full-time writing at this point. I've been on the job for 15 years, and I'm looking at new avenues as a way of progressing, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. I, as you know, I'm also a police officer, and after
I didn't know that.
Oh, you don't know that? Okay, well now you do know that.
I'm sorry.
That after 26 years, you know,
I dyed my roots brown.
Yeah, when you put the badge on and the gun every day, you do look for new avenues after a while. You love your job, but you have to stay sane after a while. Diane Fanning's here. She's a crime author with a new book called The Trophy Exchange. Tell us a little bit about that, Diane.
Well, The Trophy Exchange features a cop. The main character in it is Lucinda Pierce, who has had a couple of years that have gone really bad for her. Half her face was shot off from a shotgun.
Jeez.
She killed a three-year-old boy in a shootout, and now she's trying to solve a serial murder case. But her prime suspect is a well-respected doctor who does international charitable work. So things are not going real well for Lucinda, and that's the basis for The Trophy Exchange.
Wow,
and it's a departure for me because I normally write true crime.
And speaking,
well, I'm doing both now.
Speaking of true crime, Pat Brown, the criminal profiler, who is featured on the Nancy Grace Show, deals with true crime all the time. What's been up with you, Pat?
Well, I've just gotten back from India, actually. So I've spent 3 weeks. I could consider this vacation, but I also did a presentation there to detectives, and I'm starting a the first criminal profiling training program in India. So wow. Branching out internationally, and it's been rather fascinating because in India, I've looked at a lot of different crimes as I've been there. You read in the newspapers, they've got the same kind of newspapers we do. There's murders everywhere. And sometimes we'll hear about things like dowry murders, which are, you know, we don't have in the United States, but women in India are killed over dowries, which is money that they men get with the marriage to the
right.
women. And sometimes they don't get enough dowry, then they harass the woman's family. Well, actually harass the woman and torture her until the family gives up more money, and then when they stop giving it to her, sometimes cooking oil is thrown on her and she's lit up and she dies and they move on to the next woman.
Huh.
So it's a unique crime to India. But actually, when you actually examine the crimes there, they're not different in the sense that the motives are the same on both sides of the ocean. The motives of greed, the motives of frustration, anger, rage, hostility, all these motives for crime are the same. They just express themselves differently in each one of the cultures. So it's been rather fascinating to see how one can use criminal profiling in India as well as in the United States.
Absolutely. Donna Pendergrass is here. She's a prosecutor who works on murder cases. Donna, the media, and we're going to talk about murder cases this evening, is big time into high-profile cases, reporting on them, doing shows on them. You have hosts that think that they're detectives that go out and try and solve the case. And, you know, our other colleague, Robin Sachs, who we'll get to in a minute, and I have talked about this before, but how difficult is it today compared to 5-6 years ago, where now a lot of these cases are being tried, and maybe that's not a fair term, but at least being reported heavily in the media for prosecutors like yourself?
Well, you know, Dana, it's not only that they're being reported heavily in the media, there's a lot of other things that go along with us being a TV society that really changes how we have to work as prosecutors. You know, 6 or 7 years ago, you didn't have what we pretty much all call the CSI effect.
Right.
I mean, if I didn't have fingerprints, you know, 6-7 years ago, I didn't put a fingerprint expert on to say why I didn't have fingerprints. Now, you know, we call it negative evidence, but we put it on because everybody expects, like CSI, that, you know, the crime's going to be solved in an hour. And you're going to have DNA and all sorts of things. And unfortunately for me, my specialty, I also supervise, not many people know this, but our computer predator unit. But in terms of my cold cases, you know, they're pretty much cold cases. The one I just finished, the most recent big one was, you know, 1979. So we're talking almost 30 years ago, and you don't have those sorts of things. You don't have the DNA. So it makes the case a lot more difficult because you have to explain in advance to a jury in jury selection and even in your opening statement what they can expect to hear. It's a whole different ballgame these days. And, yeah, as prosecutors, we all have had to revamp our styles considerably to, you know, to keep up with what our potential jurors are, in fact, seeing on TV.
Now, all of us have discussed the Rebecca McEvoy case and Robin Sachs, L.A. County sex crimes prosecutor. Say that three times real fast. is here, and there was a court hearing yesterday about issuing a gag order in this case. Not only does the defense want the lawyers to be gagged, I don't mean literally, but no, maybe literally, but they want guys like me and the family and everyone else to be gagged. How crazy is that, Robin?
Well, I think that the desperation level is clear, and really what they're trying to set up in this case is a pretrial publicity issue so that they can try to remove the venue of the court hearing from the jurisdiction that the case is currently in, where they've successfully gotten some local media, and by taking it at people who are nationally involved, giving more credence to the argument of having widespread exposure. But someone who lives in Los Angeles and having just actually left a court appearance of my own where there were you know, 10 cameras there. It's a hard sell that, you know, some internet blogs and a few local radio stations and some very passionate, wonderful people are causing an unfair trial for a pedophile.
Yeah, exactly. What I thought I would do tonight, gals, and if we stayed on a static topic like, you know, Charles Manson, I think we're going to bore the audience pretty quick. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to pick a whole bunch of different topics, something like what you do at your blog, womenincrimeinc.blogspot.com. And we'll go around the table and we're going to talk about it. And the first topic that I would like to throw open, and we'll start with Stacy, is the recent acquittal of the three NYPD officers who shot and killed Sean Bell in New York City. Stacy, this is a, well, you know, all you have to do is go back to some of the other high-profile cases in Los Angeles and other places and seeing the cops in the media now. What shocks me with this case and the acquittal is, you know, there was a bit of a firestorm for a couple of days. Now it's been a couple of weeks or a week or whatever it's been. We haven't heard anything. But what do we do now as law enforcement officers? We're under the microscope even more. The media reports one thing. Do we see all the facts and hear all the facts? No, I don't think we do. So we're not really sure the totality of what happened there. But I want to start with you, and then we'll go around the table and get everyone's thoughts on the Sean Bell case.
Dana, you know, obviously, my point of view is completely different as far as what the media is reporting. Recently, I've had several of my coworkers involved in fatal shootings with civilians. I lost a coworker and a friend Christmas night to a shooting. From what I've seen in the Sean Bell case, what's interesting is I think the acquittal was absolutely the right route. What you had is reports of shots fired. These detectives show up to this melee outside of the bar. They're giving commands. These people are not responding to the commands. It's a scary situation. I've been in that situation before. When you're ordering somebody, you know, let me see your hands. They're reaching underneath the seat, and they're driving the car at the detective. That in itself, at least here in Ohio, somebody is driving their car at you. That is open season for the right to shoot. I think the judge was right in this decision. It's overshadowed, of course, by, you know, Al Sharpton doing this big protest and everything downtown. And
right.
Unfortunately, the feds are now coming in to retry the case, which I totally disagree with. It's similar to what you saw out in Los Angeles with Rodney King.
Right.
You know, they need to leave it to the state to make the decision and leave the decision with the state. And here, again, they're intervening where I don't believe they should.
You know, all you have to do is, you know, to coin the old phrase, walk a mile in our shoes, and you're at a bar brawl and you're outnumbered, you know, you and your partner are there, a couple of hundred people to two or to four, it becomes really interesting really fast. Pat Brown, here's a situation where Al Sharpton's going to shut down New York, the whole world is focused on this, people are crying and screaming murder, these officers obviously their days of being officers are over. What do you think? You know, this isn't really a profiling issue, but it's certainly a high-profile case.
Right. I think, well, you know, I also have a daughter who is a police officer, and, you know, I hear her stories, and I've been out on ride-alongs with her. So I've gotten a little taste of being there and watching what goes down, not just as a profiler, but or as a mother, but as, you know, someone who's just at the scene at the time. And I think what a lot of people do not realize is that they kind of expect that the police show up and everything is very clear when the police arrive at the scene, and they should know exactly what's going down, and there should be absolutely no moment of unknowingness, shall we say, or fright, or, you know, they think it's just such a clean scene, kind of like you'd see on TV. You're able to replay the whole thing and know exactly what's going on. What they don't realize is the behaviors of the people at the scene can be very disconcerting when you arrive, and you're put in a situation, all of a sudden all hell is breaking loose, and you have to make those split second decisions. And what after the fact is over, what happens is the people who end up getting killed often are portrayed as they have wings grown out of their back. They're little angels now, and they never did anything wrong. They were simply the nicest, most cooperative, most honorable, most everything you can say about a citizen. But that is not actually a situation most of the police are walking into. They usually walk into disaster zones where people are acting in manners which are very, very frightening, and they're trying to maintain control and provide safety for the citizens there, and they're doing what they have to do. And I think that we never hear that part of it.
That's
what we get is this very distorted picture that comes out of the media, and that's why we really never know. You know, for the citizen people out there, they rarely really get the feeling of what went on and what the police were confronting when they got there.
Diane Fanning, crime author. You don't see a lot or hear a lot of positive news stories about police officers. You know, you see the Drew Peterson cases, and you see the other cases of police officers accused, convicted, or suspected of something. You're going to write a book on Sean Bell. There's human interest, obviously, on both sides. There's the cop side. There's the family side. This has got to be a tough call. You know, how do you portray everyone, or do you just go down one particular way and let the public decide?
Well, I think it's very difficult to make people understand what that situation is like for a cop when they arrive there to chaos. And I think that it would be vital to present something, an honest appraisal, to not go through that and try to take them there and get them to see it through the police officer's eyes. And by the same token, although there are people like Al Sharpton who I think are out there for publicity and not really because he's all that alarmed about the state of justice, but there are others who honestly believe that a wrong has been done, and they have their own baggage and their own viewpoint, and you need to present it that way. There are times when police officers in the line of duty shoot someone that didn't need to be shot.
Right.
But that does not mean that the police officer did something criminal. What they were perceiving at the moment may have made them feel that the public around at the scene or the other police officers were in danger of losing their lives. And
yeah,
we expect them to care for us and to protect us in that way.
Absolutely.
And if the majority of police officers were like Drew Peterson, our society would have gone to hell in a handbasket a long time ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Vanessa Leggett, the oath is to protect life and property, and you know, you're allowed to use deadly force to protect your life also as a police officer. Has the media done a good job, or because this is so sensitive, not only from the racial issue but from the law enforcement issue, has the media maybe slipped up a little bit and only focused on reporting the family side?
You know, I haven't read enough coverage, to be candid, to really make that assessment, but, you know, the media can only work with what they can work with. They should keep, you know, information from all of the parties. I don't know the level of reporting or what specifically you might be speaking of, but I would think that you would want to get as many viewpoints as possible.
Let's start with Donna. You're prosecuting cops in any high-profile case, and then we'll go into Robin's response. Not only is this sensitive, not only are you prosecuting those that you work with, and granted, there are bad cops that need to be prosecuted, you've got the media, you've got brother officers, you've got people in your office. It's got to be incredibly difficult, and then to have an acquittal like this, the blame game starts and finger pointing starts, and all of a sudden you're the bad guy or the bad gal as the prosecutor. Let's start with Donna and then end up with Robin.
Yeah, no question, Dana. It adds an additional level of scrutiny to the case. You know, you have the thin blue line. We all are kind of a brotherhood. That being said, you're right. There are bad cops that need to be prosecuted. That being said, it doesn't make prosecutor's job any less difficult, I should say. And it certainly, when you end up with an acquittal, it just adds fuel to the fire. I do want to comment on something that Pat said earlier, though, that was just a real eye-opener for me. You know, I've been doing this 21 years, and I also supervise a consortium of domestic violence attorneys. And I went to a seminar recently, and there was a very basic exercise. It was a domestic violence case scenario, and all the prosecutors had to take the roles of the police officers and vice versa. When I say take the roles of the police officers, we had computers in front of us. It was an interactive case scenario with starting with the dispatch call. You know, if you wanted more information, you had to click on the button right on the dispatch. When you got to the home, you're interacting, walking through the rooms. You could turn the characters. It was almost like what that computer game is, SimSec, whatever.
Right.
But it was like it put you in the shoes of the police officer. If you wanted to look in a drawer, you moved over and you clicked on the drawer. And then the police officers had to assume the roles of the attorneys and the case exercises and do a cross-examination. And by the end of this examination, after 2 days, police officers were saying, you can have your job back. I've got to tell you, all the prosecutors were saying, geez, when I criticized you writing your report, I never realized, you know, how many things are going on when you go into that case scenario. This just even gave me, you know, just a little eyeful of what you go through. So that, personally, for me, was a real eye-opener, and I think Pat's right. You know, there's so many things going on when you respond to a crime scene that no matter how well the prosecutor presents it to the jury, you still can't really make them understand, you know, everything that was going on. You know, when you're a prosecutor, you're trying to portray what the police did wrong, but, you know, the defense attorney has, you know, a lot to say, too, about what the police did right, because you just, you know, hindsight is 20/20, as they say.
Absolutely. Robin.
Well, I look at this case as kind of an example of no good deed goes unpunished. Here you have a case where the DA's office did what they felt was the right thing, and that was prosecute these officers, and that was the decision and the call they made, which may have been something that may have been a difficult call. And they went, they put up, you know, the fight and did what they needed to do in court, and it was the jury that decided. Wasn't any governmental branch. It was a jury, and that was the course of this conduct. And this is, you know, you see this all the time, yet it's just unbelievable to me that the second you throw police officers and race into the mix, regardless of what the outcome is, there will be an outcry.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you said it best. And something that we didn't hear is that the jury decided. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back here on the Dana Pretzer Show and continue on with our discussion with the gals from Women in Crime, Inc. And again, their webpage is www.womenincrimeinc.com. That's all one word, .blogspot.com. We'll be right back.
It's the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. And now back to the show.
Okay, we're back. We're here with several of the gals from Women in Crime, Inc. Inc. is with a K, so go to www.womenincrimeinc.blogspot.com to learn more about them. We have Pat Brown, Stacey Dietrich, Diane Fanning, Vanessa Leggett, who has to leave in about 5 or 10 minutes, Donna Pendergrast, and Robin Sachs with us. It's been in the news, although we haven't heard much about it lately, but I thought it was fascinating to see that the Crazy Charles Manson case, saga, story, whatever you want to call it, is not over. Some bones, some graves were discovered in Death Valley. There's a maybe a bit of a pun there, I'm not sure. And they were trying to tie it in back to the Manson cult. And I thought I'd start with Vanessa Leggett, crime writer, to talk about the story. Of course, we've all heard about, read about, seen the movie Helter Skelter, Vincent Bugliosi. Everyone knows Charles Manson. I did a daily commentary on Charles Manson last year talking about how he was denied for parole again, and it was amazing to me that a guy like him has been able to survive in prison so long, and boy, did the nuts come out of the woodwork on that daily commentary. I was getting emails from everyone. In fact, a few of them said they were Charles Manson. But let's start with Vanessa Leggett. Are stories ever over? You know, can you continue writing a story like this? I don't think they are. You know, here we are 40 years later, and they're finding more bones.
Well, you know, the thing is, with when you find bones and there's obviously a murder, And I don't know that they have made that determination yet.
Right.
But, you know, there's no statute of limitations. So in that regard, the case wouldn't be over once they match these bones to missing people or, I don't know, however they do that. But once they make that determination, if it is murder, then it will be opened back up. But I don't think that they have discovered whether the bones were contemporaneous with Manson and his crew, or if they're more recent, if they were recently deposited there. And that would be a convenient place to deposit bones, because perhaps people would associate it with Manson.
Well, the story kind of went on the back burner once the election and the polygamy case came to the forefront. But, you know, Vanessa, you when you write a book, well, your goal to write a book is to write something that's entertaining and interesting. People want to read. People want to buy. Okay, I think that's important. You want to sell books. You have a family that comes to you hypothetically and says, you know, my dad was a transient. He left, and we believe he was backpacking through Death Valley. He may have ended up at one of these ranches that the Manson clan was at, and we think he is one of Manson's victims. Write us a book about it. Is it that easy, or is there a lot of work involved? The writers are laughing, I know.
There is a whole lot of work involved. And, you know, whenever you examine a story to see its potential for a book, you know, a lot of stories like that are better suited for just a feature article, perhaps. To sustain an entire book, and there are others on this panel who could speak to this more than I with their experience, you have to have a real solid story, and you've got to have enough material that will let it, you know, power an entire book. And that takes a lot. So, you know, as far as just a man passing through or a vagrant, vagabond, whatever, I don't know. It depends on, you know, who that person is, who the family is. The more intriguing facts that come out, the better. But, you know, in this day and age, with the 24-hour news cycle, it's really difficult for, you know, to sell book ideas, because people get the story, they think, from any number of sources, internet, you know, television, movies, magazines, newspapers, whatever. It's out there. And so, you know, it's become very difficult. I am going to have to bow out now. I'm okay. Sorry to leave you all, but it's been great. Dana, thanks for having us on, and I will talk to you all again soon.
All right. Thank you, Vanessa Leggett.
Bye-bye, Vanessa.
Bye-bye.
That's Vanessa Leggett, a crime writer from the blog Women in Crime, Inc. Pat Brown, are criminal profilers dream to sit down and talk to Charles Manson?
Not for me. I know I'm really unusual in this, because you always hear that a criminal profiler wants to go into prisons and spend time talking to these people. But I guess to me, I've heard Charles Manson, and it's like, okay, it's this Charles Manson. He's a psychopath that lies like a dog and tries to manipulate everybody. And he's really, to me, a cookie cutter of any other psychopath sitting in prison who's doing the same thing. It really, in my opinion, serves no purpose, and I really don't get that much of a thrill out of those kind of things. I'm more interested in working on cases where we're trying to get information from some psychopaths who are on the outside and crimes that they may have committed, so that we can get them off the streets, providing public safety, and of course, get cases closed. So to me, once a psychopath is in prison for a life sentence, it really, quite frankly, doesn't much interest me. Unless they, other than maybe.
Well, no, and that's a good answer, and it kind of segues into my question for Diane Fanning. How many books, how many stories can be written about Charles Manson and his gang? There have been a ton. There have been movies. You name it, it's been done. Can you still do something with him?
Oh, book-wise, you know, I think it might be burned out. Of course, there are some people out there that would buy an empty book if it had his picture on the cover. But I think most people have just about heard enough. And if an example is this story, if everybody was just hungry for more Charlie Manson stuff, it would have stayed alive longer in the media.
Yeah, you know,
and,
absolutely.
And it just kind of faded away. Now, can you learn anything from Charlie Manson? Probably at this point, no. I think he's probably become so institutionalized that even get the real world where we live anymore.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time talking with Tommy Lynn Sells, and I learned a lot about how his crimes worked and his mind worked and why he did what he did, and I learned a lot about psychopaths from him. But I didn't even realize how traumatic it was because I was busy doing my job. And then I saw Dr. Michael Stone interview him on TV, and it just totally freaked me out.
Yep.
Seeing somebody else interview him, I had a nightmare that night. It makes no sense to me, but that's what happened.
Now, you know, it makes perfect sense to me. And we'll go to Stacey Dietrich, policewoman slash novelist, works on cold cases. All of a sudden, you get assigned this cold case. I think you want to become a full-time writer right away, don't you?
Well, Dana, I think that this is one of those particular cases that just fascinates people and will continue to fascinate people. The Charles Manson case represents the culture of the 60s, especially college-age kids now. It's almost like they're trying to relive the 60s and being... Are you there?
Yep.
Oh, okay. But, you know, it's just one of those. I read Helter Skelter when I was in high school, and I was fascinated by the case. I was fascinated by Sharon Tate, and even to this day when news that's about Roman Polanski come up, I tend to take notice. But it just seems like this is one of those fascinating cases that I have to take this. I really think that no matter how much is written on it, people will continue to be interested and wanting to read about it.
Donna Pendergrass, murder prosecutor, you get assigned this case to prosecute it, 40 years old. The evidence, a lot of it's in the media, although there is obviously other evidence in order for you to file the case. Yet your boss comes to you and says, you know, our budget's low. I don't think prosecutors ever hear that, do they? But go ahead and do that, and remember the world is watching you. How do you proceed with a case like this?
Well, you know, it's difficult as a government prosecutor because the defense attorney always has, you know, this great argument. She has the power of the government. Little do they understand, hey, I live in Michigan. Right now, our state budget, I think, is probably the worst out of the 50 states. We're talking skeletal work staff, no assistance. You know, I just finished a huge case that I pretty much did single-handedly. So it's like, what do you do? Well, you know, you do what you can. Being around as long as I've been around, you learn some tricks of the trade. Luckily for me, I have a photographic memory, so I memorize the jurors' names to get off on a good start right off the bat so they think I know what I'm talking about. But it really does, you know. Hey, you use what you got. You use what you got. It's something I can do, so I do it. My last big case, it's funny because my last big case, we were, this is about a year ago, but we were up against a $2 million defense.
Wow.
I told my secretary, I want all pristine banker boxes. I want you to label them financial records, medical, opening, closing, and I want them all lined up against the wall when we come in because I want to freak the defense out.
Absolutely.
Well, we started off with that. We went to the memorization of all the jurors' names, and I had memorized 350 juror questionnaires, which fried my brain, but
wow.
You know what? It was worth its weight in gold. But you work with what you have, you know? It's like, I didn't have $2 million, but, you know, we had banker's boxes. They looked really good. They were intimidating, in fact.
You know, Robin Sachs, Donna makes a very good point, image and appearance. You say you've got the power of the state behind you, but the account and the balance of the state's budget is $12.14. But in this case, you're working on a high-profile case. The whole eyes of the world are on you. Well, where you are right now, Los Angeles County, you can't go a block probably without seeing a TV truck or something going on. This is a difficult thing. I don't want you to talk about cases that you're working on now, but when you have a case like you mentioned at the start where there are 10 TV cameras, Is there a different way to approach it, or do you just, you know, do your job as usual?
I think that it's in everybody's best interest to do our job as we usually do it, because our job is in being trial lawyers is to educate not only the jurors that are right who are sitting in judgment on the case, but also the potential jurors who are would be could be victims and or defendants of the future, and the television viewers and everyone's the way everyone perceives a case is so dictated by media that it does no good to do it differently in front of a camera than you would actually do it in the other cases where the cameras are not in the courtroom. Because most of the times, even in Los Angeles, the cameras, you know, I comment all the time, are not in the courtroom. And there are literally, you go downtown Los Angeles, and you have 14 floors of courtrooms that people are facing unbelievable amounts of time, unbelievable amounts of violence and damage and hurt and pain have been caused to a number of people, and yet there is not a single person in the courtroom other than the judge, jury, defendant, defense counsel, prosecutor, and victim and investigating officer. And it's amazing to me about how many cases are not in front of the media, and those are the cases that the regular folks come and see day in and day out.
Yeah, for sure. And they, again, the public has a craving for these high profile cases. And, you know, if they really knew what was going on day in and day out, there wouldn't be enough reporters, TV trucks or cameras to cover everything. We're going to take a break here on the Dana Pretzer Show and come back in just a minute or two with the gals from Women in Crime, Inc. And we're going to talk about that creepy case in Austria, I believe, where the father held his daughter for 24 years in a dungeon. And believe it or not, she fathered, I think, 6 or 7 of his kids. Talk about a weird story. That's one we're going to cover here on the Dana Pretzer Show. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we're back. We're here with the gals from Women in Crime, Inc. Their blog is www.womenincrimeinc.com. Is how you spell ink, so it's all one word, .blogspot.com. I thought what we'd do is go into the story. Again, the election coverage has swallowed up pretty much all the high-profile case reporting that we've heard, but there's this creepy case. You know, think of the worst horror movie you've ever seen, or as an investigator, or as a writer, or as a DA, the worst case you've ever seen. And then think of this case where this animal locks his daughter in a dungeon for 24 years. She fathers 6 or 7 of his children. One dies. He burns it in the furnace. It's just as, you know, it's just as gut-wrenching as you can get. Pat Brown, criminal profiler. Here's one for you. You know, you may not want to look at Charles Manson, but this guy is an absolute kook. Let's talk about the dad.
I wouldn't call him a kook. I call him a psychopath. He loved the power and control he got within his own little masterminded world. And apparently, he had found the perfect wife who would pretty much go along with what he was doing.
Yep.
And I say this, and I know people are going to get upset about this, because we always think of the wife in the circumstances as an equal victim as the children. But I don't quite buy that, because it's very interesting, in a number of cases where you have men who hold women hostage in their basements or in boxes and sexually assault them, have a wife who is very cooperative, even helps in that imprisonment, because she likes the fact that he doesn't bother her any longer for his peculiar sexual needs.
Mm-hmm.
So she's perfectly happy to have a slave, sex slave, take over for her so that she can get a break. This woman, supposedly the wife, did not have a clue that her daughter and these children were down in the basement. These things were going on.
Yeah.
Which is, it would boggle the mind to believe that she could be absolutely that ignorant of the possibility that she bought every single story that he told of hook, line, and sinker. So my guess is that she was more aware than she has said that there were untoward things going on below her, but she was willing to go along with it because it eased her life and made it more possible for her to not have to suffer punishment from him, which one could call a bit of a Stockholm Syndrome herself, but it's pretty sad because she allowed her children to go through this horror and did nothing about it.
Yeah.
And so I consider her a bit of an accomplice I think we'll see more coming out on that in days to come.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the press coverage has slowed down again. But Stacey Dietrich, as a police officer, we always expect the unexpected. And just when you think you've seen it all, something else comes up. Although not, you know, a mass murder scene, this is something that has to rack on the mind of the investigators. And a lot of people, you know, when they think of the police officer, you don't hear that side of the story. The one that goes in and investigates this case, they miss the human side, and you don't see it reported on or written about very often, about the cop that has to deal with something like this and then go home and try to live their own life. We've all woken up in the middle of the night thinking of a case we've worked on, but this one's got to be something else.
Absolutely, Dana, and I agree with Pat. You know, they had claimed that this 11-year-old daughter left when she was 11 years old and wrote them a note that said she was not coming back, which is just, you know, come on. And, you know, throughout the next 24 years, this woman's living in the basement and giving birth to these children, and this wife absolutely had no clue, which is a joke. She absolutely knew what was going on. I think you're getting into the fear of her husband, which to me at that point doesn't excuse anything when it comes to your kids. There is also, I think, an allegation that he is being connected to another rape or a murder
right
somewhere in that area, which just shows, you know, the thought process of this animal is what he is. And what's disturbing about this is these kids have never seen the light of day. They can't read, no sunlight. Even the daughter, you know, is a police officer to go into a house like that and say, just walking down the basement steps and coming upon a scene like that would be one of those things that would keep you up at night, I think, for a year. It would just be so appalling and disturbing.
Diane Fanning, it won't be long and we'll be seeing books about this. We'll be seeing movies about this. Is there a fine line that one must draw when it comes to what you can write about or what, you know, is just so disgusting that you as an author say, no way, I'm not touching that?
Well, the important thing to me is to look at the story and find out, is there something here that is important for people to understand? Is there an opportunity for education? And what I look at is very clearly what I've seen in many cases over and over. There is a big secret in a man's life, and the woman turns her back, and she puts up with it, and she tolerates it. And I think, on the contrary, think it's possible she didn't know, because she didn't want to know, because she didn't want to explore it. And that's a psychological thing, not necessarily a conscious decision. And over again, you know, you look at Mark Ivanitz. He had two different wives through which he carried around this footlocker that had victims' underwear in it, and neither one of them ever looked in the footlocker because he told them not to. Michael Peterson's computer was off limits. And it wasn't until his wife finally went in and looked at the computer and saw that he was bisexual that she ended up getting killed.
Yeah.
So that it's a big red flag. If you're in a relationship and somebody says something's off limits, it's time to run.
Yeah, for sure, as fast as you can. Donna Pendergrast, this is a case, or any case, we don't, you know, specifically have to focus on this one. When you're prosecuting family on family, whether it's a, you know, the McAvoy case with an alleged a rape of a stepdaughter, or in this case, where you have this horror, for lack of a better term, but there's always that aspect of a victim recanting. Because their family, they feel threatened, they feel whatever, and you have to look at other evidence or try and handle it the best you can. You get a case like this that's gone on for all these years, the family, the media, you name it. I'd like you to comment on prosecuting family members who have committed crimes against family members.
You know, Dana, I think the most important thing with a scenario like that is that you have to educate the jury and prepare them from the start hey, we all understand what's going on here. So beginning with the jury selection, when you're asking questions of the jury, like, you know, do you understand that there may be unusual dynamics that go on when, you know, family members are testifying against family members? Those types of questions that at least get the jurors thinking, you know, like, okay, yeah, we know what's going on here. You know, you take that theme through your opening statement and really into your questioning of the various witnesses, but you need the jury to understand going in, like, hey, wait a minute, you're smarter than the witness who's going to try and fool you because it's the family member up on the stand.
Right.
You know, you understand what time it is here. And I think the biggest part for prosecutors is to get the jurors on board early on so that they understand that, yeah, when you got family on family, there's unusual dynamics, but we, as jurors, are smart enough to figure this out.
You know, Robin Sachs, we talked earlier on about the McAvoy case and how the alleged accused Engel is claiming that because Pretzer and Robin Sachs talked about his case, there's no way that he can get a fair trial, and he's looking for a change of venue and all this sort of stuff. You get a case like this or any high-profile case, the one that you're working on now, and the defense comes forward and says, you know, the media is all over this like a bird on a bug. How is my client ever going to get a fair trial? How do you handle that as a DA?
Actually, I have always experienced that media coverage is the defense benefit.
Yeah.
So I always find it to be an interesting tactic. I sometimes think it's just kind of a, you know, let me stick it to you in the back and make your life more difficult, have you have to travel farther and see if I can form shop a little bit. But frankly, media coverage doesn't seem to help the prosecution's case usually, because from that, because the prosecutor is held to higher ethical responsibilities, doesn't have the ability to pollute the information out in the community in the same way that the defense does. And the DA tends to want to make sure that the conviction is going to stick and will, you know, secure all avenues in doing so by being ethical. So whenever there's a situation where there's that kind of allegation, it definitely sends the hair on my neck, you know, on edge, because of course I'm thinking, you know, I don't want to be in a situation where I may win, you know, the short motion to keep the case in the venue, but then lose in the long run that there was unfair publicity, which then makes the case appealable. But in a case like the McAvoy case, I just can't. The burden is so high to be able to show that what the exposure of the media and the prejudice in terms of what the media exposure would do. I just can't even see it as being in the realm of possibility on that case.
You know, Joel Brodsky, the attorney for Drew Peterson, has been on my show many times, and he talks about how he wants to get Drew Peterson, kind of like what you said, in the media as much as possible. He's using that tactic because when and if files or charges are filed, you know, people will know about the case and know what's going on. So lo and behold, Drew Peterson gets pulled over, Robin, for speeding on Saturday night, and the cable news shows are all over it. I'm doing a daily commentary tomorrow where I say Drew Peterson will have his day in court or won't. There's an investigation going on, and hopefully it will come to a conclusion. But when he gets pulled over for speeding, who cares? Why are they spending time reporting on that? Because Joel Brodsky likes that kind of attention. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that the reason they do that is to the extent that they can normalize Drew Peterson as much as possible and
exactly.
Make him like an every, you know, everybody gets pulled over for tickets and
yep.
He's going to say all the things that all of us could say and would say if we were pulled over, and by normalizing him and by making him more relatable, it will certainly make the prospect of him being a vicious serial killer a lot less plausible, and it's a way to get information in front of the public without it being subject to cross-examination by an effective prosecutor.
Of course, he's out at 2:30 in the morning going to see his 22-year-old female friend. But anyway, that's another part of this. We've got about 30 seconds left for each of you, and I'm going to ask you this one question. We'll start with Pat Brown. Pat, does the media do a good job when it comes to reporting high-profile cases?
Well, I think the high-profile cases get a lot better media representation because people are spending a lot more effort on them. What's sad is sometimes the smaller cases just get a little blip and they're tossed aside, and we never actually know how they turn out. We never actually know the true facts behind them. So I'd say the high-profile ones probably, yes, a lot better than the small ones.
Stacey.
I'm going to say I don't like the media coverage in the last couple of years. I don't think they're covering accurately, and they used to, but it seems the mainstream media is picking and choosing what they're deciding to cover lately.
Diane Fanning, one of the creepiest guys I've ever talked to on the telephone, and I've done this show for 11 years, and I've been a policeman for 26 years, was John Mark Carr. That's a guy that literally I wouldn't bring on my show because he was absolutely creepy. I could say other things, but this is a family show. Does the media do a good job when we hear all the coverage about what John Mark Carr had to drink and eat on his flight from Thailand to hear, yet there are missing people that would love the news coverage?
Well, I think that a lot of times reporters are put in a bad place because they are being told by people who are not there, seeing that there really is no news, that they've got to fill a certain amount of time.
Exactly.
And so they do what they're told. And a lot of times, the stuff just doesn't get covered right because people that work for the government are constrained by certain things. They're not allowed to speak as freely as others. And so a lot of the truth of a crime does not get talked about by the police because it's got to go through the spokesperson and it's got to be sanitized so it doesn't hurt a trial. And so you get the other side much stronger. And a lot of times it's just because who you have access to.
Donna Pendergast, does the prosecution's department, the cops, the victims, do they get a fair shake in the media?
You know, Dana, you're talking to a woman whose ex-husband was a columnist for our big paper here in town.
Okay.
So, coming from a little bit of a biased perspective, but no, frankly, I think the media panders to the sensationalism. You know, I hit a serial murder case about a year and a half ago where, you know, I wake up the morning at 4 o'clock in the morning, the day the trial started, where Michigan last hope for serial murder. I didn't need that. We had to tape newspaper boxes over, you know, in the courthouse. It's just like, but it made for good press. You know what? Yeah, could somebody say that would help me? Maybe, but no. I think that, if anything, it hurt me because, you know, we had to sanitize everything from the whole courthouse. No, I think they look for a good story.
Robin Sachs, the final word goes to you.
I have to just make one comment. If it weren't for the media, all of us at Women in Crime, Inc. would have a much more difficult time selling our books. And so I think we should all be, you know, we play and pay for the right to get information and to learn things, and it's our job to just make sure that we speak to good folks out there who are portraying accurate information, like you, Dana. And the media can be a valuable resource. It could be a wonderful thing if it's used correctly.
Absolutely. And I want to remind the folks that the website, the blog for Women in Crime, Inc., and that's INK, is at www.womenincrimeinc.blogspot.com. Pat Brown, Stacey Dietrich, Diane Fanning, Vanessa Leggett, Donna Pendergast, and Robin Sachs, thank you. I'd like you to just stay on the line and remind you that our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. You'll be able to pick up the show as a podcast a little bit later on this evening. You can listen to the show live there. You can hear my daily commentary. You can leave comments. You can do just about anything. My name is Dana Pretzer. I thank you for listening. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.